Hello, everyone. This is Doug with the Fair Recovery Movement, and this is another one of our group coaching sessions. And today we've got a great guest here. His name is Kyle Benson, and we're going to be talking about how infidelity affects men who are betrayed by their partners. And while we know that both men and women stray in equal numbers, very few men are willing to talk openly about it, it seems. So today we have the opportunity to do just that. Kyle has been a betrayed partner and is happy to provide us with his story, and looking forward to listening to it and hopefully have some good information. So I'm going to turn this over to Sarah P., and we'll get going. Otherwise, welcome, Kyle.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Kyle. Welcome. I'm really happy that you're able to join us today. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself before we get started?
Yeah, it's a long story, and it might weave a little bit in with what we're talking about today.
Sure.
But probably about 5 years ago, I was in a pretty serious committed relationship and ended up having some issues with my partner, and we started doing kind of couples therapy. And during that process, for about 6 months, she was the one that actually encouraged me to go to therapy with her. She was sleeping around with someone else. And when I eventually kind of found out about it after the fact, like I knew about it initially and we took care of it, but I thought it was no longer an issue and it was still happening. Then it kind of really impacted me. That led to some other relationships where I would select kind of some emotionally unavailable partners who kind of reinforced my insecurities that were caused by that experience. And then eventually had some health issues that developed. And as a result, really looking back at my life, kind of figured, you know, what happened? How did I get to where I'm at? And my relationships kind of stood out as a core area that was not doing well. So I started trying to figure out how to improve that and started writing and started working for the Gottman Institute, and now I'm here.
That's great. So yeah. I wanted to talk about more of the details about your experience with infidelity and how it made you feel, because I believe that men and women are different in this way. Women basically have built-in social networks where they can bare their hearts to their female friends and they'll be accepted. Men don't have that as much as women do. And I've always wondered, how does that make a man feel when he doesn't have that kind of social network where he can go to other men and tell them on a very deep level what he's feeling?
Yeah, I mean, you're highlighting a pretty important component culturally that the difference between men and women. And I think my experience, I felt really alone. I mean, some of my friends knew what was going on, but most of the time during the experience, during the 6 months when things were kind of rocky and I was still with that partner, I didn't really tell anyone. I just worked out more. I worked a lot more. And then after I ended that relationship, I got into another relationship, which it felt like that partner at the time was also not necessarily, well, I would say they were having an emotional affair with someone at the same time as they were trying to have a relationship with me. And since I didn't know how to deal with that anxiety, the uncertainty, and because I really lacked confidence in myself, that was kind of shattered from that prior experience. And I started end up working like 100 hours a week just as a way to cope, a way to avoid. And kind of reflecting on it back at now, it was a way for me to try to even earn affection or love or something from even that partner who was emotionally cheating on me.
Right. And, of course, that didn't happen. What did happen?
Over time, kind of since I was working so much, my anxiety and my insecurity was really kind of through the roof. And I couldn't sleep more than 3-4 hours a night. I started drinking too. And eventually, all that stress, all that anxiety, my body kind of cracked. And I ended up getting some autoimmune issues, health issues, and still currently, you know, 5 years later, still dealing with the ending kind of phase of that process. But it was, I mean, emotionally, I was a wreck. I remember one moment where I was kind of looking in the mirror, and there just kind of looking at myself, and I was had so much self-hate towards myself. Really internalized a lot of the suffering I was dealing with and put it back on myself.
And did she do anything to feed that? I mean, did she give you any overt messages such as saying, well, if you wouldn't do da-da-da, then I wouldn't have to cheat, or anything to feed into that?
No, in the that partner, I mean, it was more like, I'm not doing anything, even though I found evidence and, like, would very easily convince me that nothing was going on. And since I had learned not to trust my gut, I kind of went along with it. And there were definitely big red flags, but never kind of what you're saying.
Okay, so she was in denial to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like she was gaslighting you pretty well, too.
Yep. It sucked. It really sucked.
Imagine
and
so.
What would she do? What did gaslighting look like? What would she do? Some examples of gaslighting.
Just kind of, you know, I would find something or highlight something, or, you know, at that point I was obviously picking up on some issues in our relationship. And I remember I even, you know, was doing some pretty insecure behaviors such as snooping, which I'm not really proud of, but I was trying to find some reassurance, and I would find things that were, I felt really inappropriate, and kind of would bring it up, and then she would just kind of pretend it wasn't, she was a non-issue, or things weren't as I was perceiving them, and just kind of, I don't know, like, just really dismiss my feelings, and one of the things that happens if you're an anxious partner, which I was at the time, is you really don't trust yourself, and you kind of see your partner's opinion be a little bit more accurate than yourself, because you have this deep kind of core belief that at some fundamental level you're unlovable. And so there's like this feeling of, oh, I got to kind of, you know, I got to find a way to make this work. I don't know if I'll ever find someone else who will really be there for me. And so that also feeds into the kind of me seeing these red flags and avoiding and ignoring them.
That's really sad. Now,
yeah.
When you say anxious, you're referring to being anxiously attached as an attachment theory.
Right, correct.
So, and did you have anxious attachment before, or did you develop it as a result of the trauma?
I definitely think I had some slight anxious attachments from my youth, from my family of origin.
Okay.
Definitely was intensified in those relationships.
Right. And reinforced.
Yeah, in very severe ways. And then that last one, that partner was, well, stop being so needy. Stop, you know, stop being so clingy. And really, I just didn't have security, or I didn't have, you know, as Amir Levine, who wrote the book Attached, you know, there wasn't the consistency, the availability, the reliability and predictability of the relationship that would allow me to feel secure and confident in having that relationship, which is also, you know, a sign for me that I realize now is why kind of is a sign that the relationship was not going well.
Right. And did you ever confront her? Did it ever occur to you to confront her and say, I know this is going on, and did she admit it?
There was never, so when I would confront, as I was kind of saying before, I would bring this stuff up, and there was a way in which she would convince me that that I was overreacting, I was being ridiculous, and that there's nothing going on, and that I needed to trust her, and I should stop being so disrespectful. And so it was really turned against me. And my feelings really were really dismissed, and because of my anxious attachment, I would listen to her, and would try to make it work, and just tell myself, you know, maybe she's right, maybe I'm too needy. And in that style, and in a typical anxious avoidant relationship, right, the partners both verify and really enhance each other's insecurities to a point where, you know, my feelings of unlovable, my feelings of being inadequate and not worthy were really kind of inflamed.
Right. And did you mention that she was anxiously attached as well, or what was her attachment style?
She was avoidantly attached.
Oh, so that's a recipe for crazy making, in my understanding.
Yep. Yeah. That type of relationship creates what the research says, stable instability. It's consistently unstable.
Right. And so with the avoidant partner, they're trying to avoid intimacy. And with the insecure partner, they're trying to be validated that, yes, we do have intimacy. We do have closeness. You do love me. And that just causes the avoidant person to draw back further. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like a chase. You know, it's like a chase, a cat and mouse chase. And unfortunately, when the anxious partner becomes triggered or there's a threat to the relationship, they start to pursue closeness. They can become demanding. They can become critical, which is kind of what I was. They can start doing protest behavior, which is like snooping or calling all the time or texting, which are some of the behaviors I did back then. And often what happens is that avoidant partner experiences that seeking for closeness as a threat, and so they withdraw even more. And so it creates this nasty cycle that never gets resolved because there's no understanding and no way to actually communicate and meet with each other's needs.
And until those people go through therapy and develop secure attachment, I don't think there can ever be a meeting of the minds. Did you find that?
I think, well, in that relationship, I ended up just leaving because it was too toxic. And my health issues became so severe that I pretty much shut off from the world for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But in my other work with couples, I have been able to work with some anxious and avoidant relationships and start to turn things around. But that does take, as you mentioned, therapy. It takes a deeper look at kind of the belief system of both partners, how both partners deal with conflict, because it's really their styles, because they're so different, that causes the inflammation and causes the issues. And almost as the couples will kind of say, you know, they fight practically nothing, but they're fighting. And what they're really fighting is we don't have the connection, or I don't have the autonomy, and there's no creative ways to create a mutual understanding where there can be a balance between kind of independence and closeness, you know, as they would call it, interdependence. And so I think there is ways to definitely work with it, but it takes a lot for both partners to really be committed and relearn how to love each other and be loved.
Right. And this is deviating a little bit from the question list, but I like to blog about attachment theory, and I always like to evaluate what kind of attachment each partner has, because I think there's a lot of information there in terms of what's going on in a marriage, how to help each partner, etc. Have you found that with studying attachment theory?
Yeah, I think you're looking at people's core beliefs, or as they call their working models, right? They have a belief system about what they deserve in relationship, what works in relationship. And when that is not communicated and when partners don't become experts on each other, there's bound to be problems. And I think attachment theory, especially, you know, I use a lot of Amir Levine's work from Attached. I use Sue Johnson, Stan Takens, done a lot of research in that. And I think the models we have today are highly informative and can really drastically change relationships around.
Right.
And I think the other thing that's important, too, is if, you know, these differences, when they're not adjusted, they open the, as John Gottman would call, a window in the house of the relationship that then allows others to kind of crawl in or opens the door and partner walks out for a little bit and starts to invite, you know, the opportunity for affairs to happen.
Yes, I've definitely seen that. And they don't even understand why they're doing it. I mean, from a third-party perspective, you can see the detachment theory comes into play, that these people are being triggered by each other. But in their mind, they're blaming the partner. A lot of them are. They're saying, well, if you met my needs in XYZ way, I wouldn't have to do this.
Right, right. There's some type of projection and a lot of, you know, they're not taking ownership of their role in the pattern. And any relationship is a two-person system. And until partners take ownership of how they're creating the pattern together, there's not going to be a resolution. Because playing the blame game or trying to find the bad guy, it just, right? You're in a cycle that's toxic and will never actually create a resolution.
Exactly. So what do you do when you see one partner who's learned to be securely attached through therapy and the other partner doesn't budge? What do you recommend to this securely attached person who still wants to heal their marriage?
Who are they attached to? Are they attached to an avoidant partner or an anxious partner?
Or let's say that they were insecurely attached, but then they went through therapy and they were able to develop learned secure attachment. But let's say they're still with a partner who is anxiously attached or has reactive attachment disorder. One person changes within that relationship system. So what do you do with that person who's gotten well? Have you found that that person can create bridges toward the other person? Or do you feel like the game's over at that point? What have you seen?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, if one person changes in a relationship, it fundamentally changes the relationship because it's a two-person system. That's what's so powerful, I think, about couples work is even if one partner starts to change how they start conversations or how they listen to their partner, right, there can be fundamental shifts over time that drastically change how partners connect. Now, I think also where I'm taking your question, though, is that they might come up against a partner who's unwilling to work on the relationship. And
yeah,
so
exactly.
When I come against that, my curiosity is what's the wall? What's within the bricks that is causing them not to want to work on the relationship? Is working on the relationship a reason, or is that somehow confronting their identity that they're a bad lover or a bad partner? Is working on the relationship scary because then they feel that the hopes they had before an affair happened or some other relationship issues happened, that those will come back again, then it's really hard for them to trust and even put in the time to work on something. Right, there's a lot of dynamics to kind of explore what's going on in the person who is unwilling to budge, who's putting up the wall, and understand what's going on in their inner world. And there also comes a point, if that partner just doesn't want to budge and doesn't want to move, then, you know, I usually have a serious conversation with both partners and say, look, guys, like, we've been trying this for a while. You know, it seems like that just the partner who's not willing to budge is not willing to work on it. And so now we have a choice. We have to choose to either, you know, stay in the relationship at the status quo, which is not satisfactory for that secure partner, or we got to look at, you know, potentially ending the relationship so the secure partner can find a relationship that's actually fulfilling and starts to get their needs met in the ways that they want to get them met. So that's a pretty tough conversation, but usually if I'm not getting through the wall, that's where I go. I haven't had to have that experience yet. But that is something that, you know, if that wall does not budge, or if there's no, that person doesn't want to make an effort, then it's going to be really hard to do a whole lot that'll change the marriage.
Yes. And the reason I was asking that question is because we have some subscribers who are in situations where they want to work on it, they're budging, but the other person just doesn't want to budge, and it's consistent. And so there's always so many questions there. Where do they go from now, et cetera? And so that's where that question came from.
Right. Yeah. And I think the best approach is to get curious. What's causing them to budge? What are they scared of? What would they have to confront? Because some way, them not working on the relationship is serving them in some way. It's in some benefit, you know, even if we can't quite see it right now, maybe it's a way of self-protection. Maybe it's a way of them preventing themselves from being hurt again. That's often how I look at walls when I deal with those types of relationships.
Yeah. So I wanted to circle back around to the question list that I had.
Yeah,
let's do it. What was the biggest issue that you struggled with during your recovery after you decided to get well? After you were cheated on and you decided to get well, what was the biggest issue that you struggled with?
Man.
Right? There's so many, I know.
Yeah,
so many.
Well, if I think back to my recovery process, I was doing a lot of health issues. I mean, I've worked with over 100 doctors trying to get my health back because my autoimmune issues have been pretty intense.
May I ask what you were diagnosed with?
Technically psoriasis, but I had a whole bunch of other issues too. I mean, I lost 30 pounds in 6 weeks. I've had five surgeries on my eyelids because they were so inflamed. If we talk about insecurities and anxieties, my skin, psoriasis, which creates like red spots, it's just a bunch of inflammation. And so there was a ton of inflammation in my body, which if I think about it, was a result of inflammation in my relationships and even inflammation in how I treated myself and viewed myself.
I saw the picture on your blog. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal.
And so you're also talking about a mind-body connection there, too. How
right.
inflamed skin can lead to inflamed skin or inflammation in the body.
Right. Well, I think all of our experiences, right, whether, I mean, in men struggle with kind of getting in touch with their feelings, and we're more of like, let's move forward, next thing, and that's kind of the mindset I had. And my recovery has been going back into my body. Trying to get that connection actually healthy. And really kind of what that recovery has looked like for me is taking care of getting my sleep, focusing on my health, but then also a lot of therapy and really focusing on building secure attachments with my friends as well and starting to risk being vulnerable with where I'm at, some of the things I went through. My family didn't have any idea of how severe the cheating and stuff had been going on. A lot of my friends didn't, actually all my friends didn't. And so kind of my recovery process was really opening up about kind of the shame I had about myself. And for any person to admit like how all this type of stuff impacts you is a really difficult experience. And what's good, though, and what came from it is as I was willing to risk, you know, expressing the shame and stuff like that, I got connection and I got new experiences that started to build new neural pathways and new relationships within myself and with other people that started to create a much more secure attachment.
Right. And people who are securely attached, if you're meeting other securely attached people, they will value your vulnerability. They won't throw it in your face or use it against you. It will be safe to talk about, and it will be accepted.
Yeah,
so
they will
match.
Match.
Gauge.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, if you go from that anxious avoidant relationship to a secure relationship, honestly, it's like living on two different planets. There's such fundamental differences, because you're in a secure relationship, your partner's available, they're responsive, they're caring. There's a sense of calmness around them. Whereas in that anxious avoidant relationship, there's a sense of anxiety, uncertainty, ambiguity, and you can't ever, you know, you always feel unstable. Yeah, it's much different.
And here's something that I've always wondered about, and this deviates from the question list, but I've noticed that some people can't seem to break away from that drama, even though it's bad for them. And do you have any comment on why that would be, why some people actually thrive on that drama, even though it's killing them on the inside?
And if I were to look at that, I would go to self-verification theory. In some component, that drama verifies some aspect about some deeper core belief they have about themselves. And so there's something in that relationship, that pattern of that relationship, that feels familiar, that feels comforting. And they have yet to have experiences where they can't have that, where they don't have that drama, and the relationship is actually okay. And I think the people that do create a lot of drama do it because they're trying to get connection, they're trying to get attention, they're trying to stir up something that's saying, connect with me, get close to me, you know? And unfortunately, it is done in such a way that actually causes the opposite reaction. And so they have these experiences kind of through childhood and even in their adult relationships where they have been dramatic, and that's how they've actually gotten connection. They've gotten some response out of that. And so there's a belief that if I'm not dramatic, then I'm not going to get a response and I'm going to be alone, or something catastrophic is going to happen. That's typically how I would look at those type of dramatic clients.
And then there is something that I've noticed where, for example, I have noticed people who have been in very good relationships by all standards, and they will actually run from that relationship into one that's very toxic. And I've always wondered why.
Yeah, again, it comes back down to the beliefs they have about themselves. They almost unintentionally sabotage it, because if they have someone that really loves and cares about them, it goes against their belief system about themselves. And so to stay in that relationship, to actually accept love and affection as they are, is a discomforting experience, because that's not what they're used to. And so instead, they will find reasons to reject that partner, they'll find ways to escape, and they'll end up, in a way, destroying that relationship, and then finding themselves back in kind of the toxic pull of those other relationships where it's unstable, they're anxious, they're, you know, dramatic. And again, it comes back to on a fundamental level, how are you seeing yourself and how do you feel about yourself within your relationships? And that's, I think, with attachment theory is really important, is how do you get to a point where you see yourself as lovable? And this is where I really like the work of Brené Brown, and really kind of, even if you look at her book, Rising Strong, of how do you start to really be with yourself and really start to love and appreciate yourself so you can actually create a relationship not only with yourself, but with someone else. And that's how I would see that.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And sometimes I've told people about these things and they struggle with taking that even in, because it's just too much. And I always wonder, well, once again, what's that wall that you can't get past?
Right. Exactly.
When you bring this to light and they still can't get over it. I always wonder, right, if there's just too much trauma in childhood. You took the same trauma course that I took, and I always wonder if that goes back to trauma or what else is going on under there.
Yeah, it is to a degree trauma, and I think that becomes their experience, and so they're so comfortable with that toxic relationship that it feels familiar. And so the safety, the security that comes from a healthy relationship in their body and in their mind almost feels like they're jumping out of an airplane in a parachute. It just doesn't make sense. It's not, it's something that feels so unfamiliar in their brain because it hasn't experienced that. It doesn't have the neural pathways to say, hey, we're okay. We're calm. This person cares about us. This is wonderful. Let's hang out. It causes them to want to run from it. And because it's such a new and foreign experience, it actually feels more like a risk to them than it is to the familiar part of that actual toxic relationship.
Yeah, that's great. That's great that you point that out. It's basically somebody else's normal could be radically different from my normal. And I've seen in trauma work where people have come from horribly abusive childhoods, and yet they can't come to break off that relationship with their abuser. They might invite that abuser to walk them down the aisle. And in their world, right, it's normal, whereas in a healthy world, it's, why would you invite your abuser to walk you down the aisle? That makes no sense, but to them, that's normal. It's a totally right. different frame of reference.
Right. Well, yeah, because that's what their experiences have associated with love, right? We make meaning of our experiences in some way. Oh, this partner abuses me. Well, they love me. They do this because they care about me. They control me. They do these things, right? In some way, the mind has to interpret and seek to understand and digest what the experiences are. And so they create a meaning behind it. And because they don't have those healthier experiences, there's no place right. for those experiences actually to be linked.
And then you go back to the neural pathways where they don't even have the neural pathways to make sense of a healthy experience. That's
exactly.
not how they've been formed, but they're formed,
right.
basically. So
right.
let's go back to the gender element. What do you think is different between men and women's recovery from infidelity if a man was cheated on versus a woman? What do you think is different for men going through that?
Well, if we look at, I'll talk a little bit about biology and then I'll kind of get into more of the cultural stuff, which I think is a little bit bigger. But biologically, men have a little bit of what I would call a shorter fuse. They're more likely to be flooded, and it takes them longer to recover. This just comes from some of the research, especially in conflict conversations or especially in issues in which they're overwhelmed. So that, I think, it takes, for men, it takes a while to really, you know, regulate themselves and calm themselves when something like that happens. And then I think the other thing we talked about earlier is the cultural bind that men are put in, where they're not taught to be expressive, they're not taught to reach out. There's this mentality of, especially in the United States, I got to be independent, I got to do it on my own. And if we go back to attachment theory, most men, you know, out of the avoidant styles, most avoidants are men. They don't have experiences of sharing their emotions. They don't have ways in which their partners or their parents were available to them. And this kind of comes from our cultural conditioning. And so it really puts men in kind of a bind of, you know, what do I do with this? How do I cope with this? And so I think that's where you can get some workaholism, alcoholism, drugs, other things that come in as a tool for that person to try to soothe them, to try to regulate what's going on. And unfortunately, it's a pretty destructive and almost avoidant way of trying to regulate their emotions and really what they're struggling with. And they really struggle, I think, with men facing actually what's going on sometimes.
Got it. And do you think that the way that men are raised in this culture has to do, and do you think that comes into play? Because I have seen just some societal norms where if a boy cries, it's okay, pick yourself up off the playground. And if a girl cries, it's, oh, poor baby, let me hold you. There's still some of that goes on where men are not supposed to connect to their feelings from the time that they're boys.
Right. Well, that comes back to being how we're culturally conditioned, right? And it's this, you know, I think boys, if you look at the research, boys are not touched or held as much as girls. They're just not. And that has an impact. And, you know, and then, it, you know, if you look at differences on playgrounds, a girl gets hurt on the playground and or says, hey, you know, you're not playing with me, and all the girls get around and they have a conversation. That happens, you know, with boys and they're playing soccer on at recess. you know, one of the boys will go and hand the soccer ball to the boy who's crying and then say, all right, game on. There's no talking. There's no connecting. It's just, you know, how can we resume the game as fast as possible? And I think that's a lot of the mentality of what men kind of take on is, how can we get back in the game? How can we, you know, get back to where we were before instead of slowing down and going, how does this impact me emotionally? For me, getting connected to my emotions is quite a long process, and it was not exactly an easy process. Because I wasn't really able to express that, be in touch with them.
Right. I have two boys, and I knew about this research before they were born. And so I kind of intentionally broke the mold just on a personal level. I thought, okay, boys don't get held enough. Well, I'm going to hold my boys all the time. I'm going to tell them how much they're loved and how much they're valued. And we're going to talk about feelings. And we do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's the research shows, even from John Gottman stuff, you know, emotion coaching, where you're starting to get them to express their feelings, will make them more resilient as adults, because they'll be able to say, you know, even in their career, if their boss is doing something they don't like, they'll say, hey, this is bothering me, and here's how this makes me feel. And they'll be able to have language for it instead of trying to stuff it, hide it, or act out those behaviors in unhealthy ways.
Exactly.
So I have a question for you along those lines. And a lot of times we're dealing with people that are, you know, my age, 55, 56 years old, and they've got, you know, obviously a lifetime of habits and character issues and everything. I mean, is it possible to change that, the way they feel in that respect that you just described, after so many years of being, you know, ingrained in them?
Yeah, I think it takes a little bit more time, but I think there's definitely a possibility to create some more freedom and more connection.
I know the people that we deal with, they're like begging their husbands to get to that point.
Right.
You know, it's something that they really long for and that they really need in order for them to heal from the affair. And that, I mean, it'd be awesome if it was something that, there was some easy way to do it, but obviously we know that's not the case. But, it's just pretty much intensive therapy then, I guess, is what would be called for, in your opinion.
Well, a little bit, and I think it's trying to understand, what does emotion mean to you, right? We talk about meta emotions. What are your feelings? What are your feelings actually about your feelings? And when you feel sad, how do you feel about feeling sad? Does that piss you off? Does it feel like you shouldn't feel sad? You know, what happens when you feel helpless? You know, what does that? Do you go into action mode? Do you avoid that? Do you start drinking beers? You know, there's a lot of really understanding what I would consider their belief system about their feelings. And if, you know, when I work with men, you know, typically around that age, we're exploring, what does it mean for you to be sad or for you to not express your feelings? And what I often find is those men go, I've been freaking stressed out. I just didn't know it. I haven't been connected to myself. I haven't, you know, really understood how to use this. And it's again,
right,
like walking to an ocean. It's kind of foreign and it's cold and you're not really sure, you know, what's underneath your feet. And one of the things that I do with those types of clients is I start to have them try on their feelings. So I have like a booklet where we have a list of, you know, what society would consider positive feelings and then what I would consider darker feelings, ones that we try to pretend are not there. And so they try them on. No, I'm feeling really agitated right now. Okay, well, tell me about that feeling. What's going on there? And I find that as they start to try on feelings, they start to develop a vocabulary of what's going on in their internal world. And most often men, you know, as you're saying, they don't have experience of what that looks like. Instead, they kind of go, I'm feeling something. I don't know what it is. I don't know what to do with it. Move on.
I'm going to go watch TV.
Exactly. Their TV is a way of numbing out.
That's why we have man caves.
Yeah, yeah. And their wife's sitting there going, I want to feel you. I want to feel connected to you. I want emotional contact. And the husband's going, I don't know how to do that. Sorry, I'm going to watch
alone.
TV. Yeah. And it's
well, and that's why a lot of these hard discussions after infidelity are so difficult for couples, I think. You know, what you just described is, you know, you got one person trying to dig deep into the whys and trying to understand thing, and you have the other person that all they want to do is get out of the room. And, you know, it's a difficult situation.
It is. And that's, I mean, what I do with couples, I usually kind of watch their heart rates. I use a pulse oximeter, and we're checking for flooding, because in just before the flooding or before that partner, as you said, kind of that wants to leave the room, they're shutting down emotionally.
Right.
And so in that, there's a way to engage that and start to go, what's going on for you that's causing you to shut down? And there's, again, I think it comes back to, what's it mean that she's upset? What's it mean that she's trying to connect and she feels like she can't? Right? How's that impacting you? And usually then there's like frustration, there's anger, and you start to kind of open up, you know, and take down the shield that guy's been carrying for so long, and there's a hope for new vulnerability and some new connection.
Right.
And then with men, isn't shame one of the big feelings that comes into play that they try to suppress?
Yeah. Well, shame's whole goal is to isolate, disconnect, and prevent you from sharing. And that's, you know, Brené Brown says it's 99.9% of what's in the room. It, as a therapist, that's what you're watching, that's what you're experiencing. And for men, because we don't know how to share our feelings, you know, even that, right? You have a partner who's saying, share with me, connect with me, and the guy's going, I don't freaking know what to do. And so even in that moment, they're experiencing shame of, I don't know, I can't connect that. I don't have that ability, right? And so they just shut down. And shame is a really powerful and toxic emotion, because it really tells you, oh, don't connect, you know, isolate, stay alone. And unfortunately, when shame is not engaged, it creates further disconnection and isolation in that marriage.
Right. And how does a man begin to get over shame? What can he do? Do you have any steps for him?
Yeah. So I use a lot of Brené Brown's work. She talks about shame shields. And so it's learning, okay, when I start to experience shame, what do I do? Do I turn towards my partner and become the super nice guy and pretend it's okay? Do I turn away and go into my man cave and hide and pretend nothing's going on? Do I become really critical and aggressive and start yelling? Right, so there's kind of those disconnecting strategies. I believe that's what they're called. That's what the research calls them. And so that's kind of how we operate with shame. And then what I try to do is I try to build space between that, the person who's experienced the shame, and the actual shame. You know, we try to differentiate. Shame is really not you. It's an emotion you're feeling, and we start to figure out what's the story that it's telling you about yourself. You know, what are the physiological signs? Oh, are you sweating? Does your jaw tighten? Does your head hurt? And you start to be able to get indications of shame. And then from there, you kind of create, okay, based off of, you know, I'm starting to experience shame, I know the one thing I need to do is I need to talk about shame. I need to talk about the shame. Because when you start to talk about shame, as Brené Brown puts it, empathy is a hostile environment for shame. And so when it starts to be connected to a therapist or someone who's going to be really empathetic and really sit in the experience with you, all of a sudden it loses its power. It loses its grip. And having those repeated experiences over time can really start to free the person from their shame.
Wow, that's great. Doug?
Yes.
Do you have any questions?
Well, I wanted to kind of circle back to something that you had said earlier, Kyle, when you first started talking about your experience, and that was about your losing trust, or you didn't trust yourself. And I know that's a very big problem, and a lot of times I don't think initially people even realize that they didn't trust themselves, but can you give us maybe a few ideas or things that you may have done that helped you to rebuild that trust in yourself as well as trust in others in relationships?
Ooh, that's a great question. Let me unpack that a little bit. building trust in myself was really starting to figure out what bothered me and being authentic with that. That comes even to a level of acknowledging that I have needs and that those needs deserve to be met. You know, even asking, like, I think a while ago, an instance that's coming to mind, I was not feeling well, and I was, you know, I wanted my partner to bring me some soup because I wanted to be cared for. And there was a part of me that's like, it's kind of childish to do that. It's, don't do that. Right? You're fine. That was my old story. And I had to take the risk of trusting myself that, you know what, I really do need that. I do want that type of nurturing in this moment, and I want to be cared for. And so that's, I think, kind of one of the things I did. I've done a lot of therapy, too, in trying to get connected to what I'm feeling. And try to also take risk in expressing what's going on and having conflict with my partner where I can say what I'm experiencing and what I'm feeling, and we can start to figure out a way to work through whatever that conflict is. And that takes a lot of trust to really admit, and I think trusting yourself and trusting your partner is really being willing to be vulnerable and say, hey, babe, we got a problem. You know, how do we navigate this? How do we work through this? Instead of I'm leaving you or doing stuff in something in a really passive aggressive way. Does that answer your question? I feel like I kind of scattered around.
No, I think that's good. No, you answered that very well. And I just, like one of the things that I know Linda did, that's my wife, that you know, when she didn't trust herself, she made kind of a conscious effort to start to do things that gave her confidence. And it could have been as small as just, you know, I don't know, doing something at work where, you know, she's a great teacher. Okay. So she may have poured herself into work a little bit more to kind of gain some confidence, or, you know, she may have done some other things to do that. And that was a big turning point for her too, to help her to trust that she can make good decisions and that she was confident in doing it. Because a lot of times I think what people think that when they're betrayed is that, boy, you know, what did I do wrong? What, you know, am I not worthy and all this kind of stuff. And they start to not trust their decision making and all that sort of thing. And it's really a total loss of confidence in a lot of different levels.
Right. Well, the whole world becomes unsafe because usually right. with when you're cheated or you have an affair, it comes out of the blue and most people that go through affairs, that partner that's been betrayed usually actually gets PTSD.
Sure.
They're hypervigilant. They're kind of uncertain of you know, yeah, they don't feel safe. And so it's how do you start to build that safety within yourself? And within your marriage that allows you to start to trust and rebuild that. And that, again, I think that comes back to that takes risk.
Sure.
And that's hard. And to trust is to take risk. And so it's complex and it's difficult and it's some of the best work you can do.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people kind of find a little safety zone in that where they're afraid to take that risk and they almost like to be, I don't know if I want to use the word like to be, but, you know, it's just more secure for them to be in that position where they aren't, you know, taking that risk.
Right. Well, it's their comfort zone, right? And that's
sure.
So nice to not have to take risk, to kind of sit back and oh, I have this stuff, but I don't really want to say it. I don't have to risk, right? To risk trusting someone is also the risk to have that trust broken.
Right.
It's reaching out your hands, and by reaching out, the other person also has the choice to reach out and grab your hand, or reach out and slap your hand, or not reach out at all. And that's a pretty vulnerable experience to say, hey, here's what I need. Are you gonna help me? And that's trust, and that trust is, you know, it needs evidence. And when I work with couples that trust has been broken, I really try to find evidence of how can you guys start to trust each other? How can we start to create a relationship where both of you feel safe, and we can start to have these conversations where, you know, what's going on is actually okay, and continue to make progress to build that trust and that commitment towards each other.
Right. That safety element that you mentioned is so key. It's unbelievable. I mean, from both from both points of view. I mean, the point of view of the betrayed person needing a safe environment, and even from the other side, you know, if the unfaithful partner is constantly getting, you know, attacked or punished or blamed or whatever, they're not going to want to do anything. They're not going to want to say anything or discuss the situation. So it has to be a safe environment for both people.
Exactly. That's spot on.
And Kyle, I wanted to ask something about insecurity again. How does somebody get through the constant trigger where, now, a lot of people, when their partner has an affair, they internalize it and they say, what is wrong with me? I'm not enough. Why am I not enough? And then that brings the shame. And even if they're in recovery, every time they look at their partner, they're reminded that they're not enough. It's not logical, but it is. And how do you defeat those kinds of feelings?
That's a great question, and that's what a lot of people struggle with. They often take their relationship as a core indication of their failure and them being unlovable. What I do when I work with those people is I start to differentiate their relationship from their self-identity. I start to look at, what are the other things that add worth to your life, right? You know, if your relationship is the only pillar that your self-worth, your self-identity is created on, that's a pretty risky thing. So, you know, you have a career, you have friendships, maybe you have kids. You know, are you a good father? Are you good in your career? Do you have some good buddies that really enjoy you? And we really start to find things outside the relationship to start to create space between the identity and the relationship. And I feel like that's one of the a space to create that. And then really also evaluate, what are the beliefs telling you, right? In some way, the way that they're saying, I'm unlovable, I'm not worthy, it also has a purpose, I believe. And if they, however they navigate that, if they say, oh, I'm unlovable, and they start taking a bunch of actions to save the relationship, well, that story, that narrator in their head is really trying to support them in saving the relationship. You know, if the other thing that happens is they shut down and they go off or they withdraw, right, it's trying to protect them from taking risks where they could get hurt again. So I think it's kind of twofold, where you're evaluating what's the purpose of that story and how's it serving you. And then the second part is to really explore of, you know, that's not quite the entire truth, right? You're not completely unlovable. Let's start to find some evidence, and what I call start to create a treasure chest of positive things that show that, you know, you do have a lot of value. You do have a lot of self-worth.
And most of all, most of the time, in fact, all of the time, the affair is never about that person.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we do forget that if we've been cheated on. We think, oh, we come up with a laundry list that if I was more this, if I was thinner, if I was prettier, if I was this, if I was that, if I made more money, they wouldn't have cheated. But that's not true. And so that whole I'm not enough and so they cheated needs to be removed from the narrative entirely. And yet it's there.
Right. It is there. And that's what I said, like when I was working 100 hours a week, that's what I was trying to do. I felt I was unworthy. And so I tried to, in a way, become so financially successful that I could win this partner. But that was a really mistaken belief on my part, because that wouldn't have changed our relationship dynamics. And the best thing for me in that relationship would have been to walk away. Now, in other relationships, it might be to confront what's actually going on and start to talk about, hey, you know, the fact that you cheated on me really makes me feel unlovable. You know, I feel like I really failed, you know, and to really start to process the emotions and the feelings that are there.
Right. Yeah, because that's one of the most common triggers that seems to come up when people are trying to recover. And the triggers are often not just that, but other triggering thoughts can sometimes hijack the recovery process. And speaking of that, what do you do when people are bombarded with constant triggers? Either it's the date that they found out it's D-Day, or they found out that the other person was at that favorite restaurant with their spouse, or the other person lives near their house, so there's always a trigger. What do you do with those recurring triggers that are really bogging people down?
Yeah, I work to process the feelings that are beyond that are in those triggers. I mean, there's certain things, right? If you have an affair, or if your partner has an affair, and they took that affair partner to your favorite restaurant, and that restaurant's 5 minutes from your house, inevitably you're going to be driving by that place. And so it's really starting to look at, okay, what does this mean to me? How does this impact me? And often, as you're naming, they start to take it very personally, and it comes a personal story about themselves, and that's where shame comes in, really starts to beat them up. And it tells them, you're unlovable, you're inadequate, you're not doing, you know, this or that, and it really hijacks them. And that's shame's goal. It really wants to hijack you. It wants you to feel bad, and really kind of keeps you in that isolation.
Yeah, for sure.
Your question?
Doug, did you have another question?
Well, since we're trying to kind of talk about a little bit about the man's experience dealing with infidelity, is there anything that you can think of that you would have done differently had you if you were given the chance? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I would have reached out a lot sooner. I had no idea how much I was bottling up inside, and how hurt I was feeling by everything. It took me a good two, three years to take a really serious look at what was going on, because I had bottled it up and stuffed it down so much. And so,
do you think that's a typical man's reaction then, to bottle it up like that?
I think it is. I think for me, for most men, it's to bottle it up and move on. If I stuff it, if I hide it, if I can disconnect with it from some way, then things will be okay. But unfortunately, those things, those emotions, while getting bottled up, reappear in other aspects of the relationship and in that person's life. While we try to banish our emotions, they never vanish. They'll always come back, even in indirect ways that will impact, you know, a person's health and their relationships.
And then I guess hand in hand with that, my guess is, you got any other kind of advice for men who are struggling with their wives at this point?
You kind of cut out. Can you repeat that?
Oh, sorry. Do you have any advice for men who are struggling with betrayal? I mean, anything that's best advice that you can get at this point is their spouse has betrayed them and they're trying to recover and heal their marriage?
Yeah, I think my recommendation is I would go to, if you can get your spouse, go to a couples therapist. And go to a couples therapist who has training in affairs and has successfully helped affairs. I would not recommend an independent counselor in that way, but a couples therapist who is specialized in working through some of this stuff. I think that's probably
recommend.
One of the best. Go ahead.
Do you really recommend counseling while one of the partners is still in the affair?
Oh, counseling while the affair is still going on? Is that what you asked?
Correct.
Oh, so do you recommend counseling while the affair is still going on?
Well, if there's couples counseling while the affair is going on, the couples counseling is not working.
Yeah, it can't be.
Well, no. A lot of the times, yeah, what people do is, you know, okay, the wife or husband or whoever finds out their spouse is having the affair and they drag them to couples counseling. And my idea is that that's probably a waste of time and money, but I just want to get your opinion on that, if you feel the same way or not.
Yeah, I won't work with couples unless there's a commitment to in the affair.
Great.
And that usually I have an independent conversation with the partner who's had the affair or is having the affair,
mm-hmm.
and say, look, like I'm not going to be able to help you because you're not willing to commit to this relationship. And then I start to get curious about what's going on for you that's causing you to not, you know, step into this. And kind of talk about the research around that, you know, and the comparison, because when you're having an affair, that affair partner is highlighted so much more, and the your current partner who you're cheating on usually is really put in a negative perspective. And that's just not an accurate picture. And so we really start to talk about that and start to go, okay, like, you know, what's this doing? And really have an honest conversation about, okay, what do you want? You know, I can't help your marriage if you're going to continue to slide and do some slippery things.
Right.
So how often have you found that the affair is addictive, though?
What was that again?
When the affair actually takes on an addictive quality within their brains, they're getting the dopamine surge and the norepinephrine surge, the excitement. How do you work with those men when they're in that affair fog, as we call it on the site?
Or women.
Or women, exactly.
Well, I start to look at, you know, kind of, I look at those feelings and I actually help them grieve. If they're willing to actually cut it off, we start to grieve that joy and the stuff they felt, and really start to unpack what that affair partner gave them. And something, that emotional connection, if they're not willing to leave the relationship, right, and they want to keep the marriage going, then you got to look at, okay, well, you know, you want to save your marriage, and yet you're still hooked and addicted to this other person. What's this other person giving you? What's the joy? What's the feeling? What's the emotional connection you're getting? And start to unpack that, and then, you know, start to go, okay, you know, based off of kind of what's going on in your life, is this connection accurate? And start to unpack, is, you know, if you want to leave your partner, would this person be the person you'd be with? Or is there something else going on? And usually there's something else going on. And when you unpack that, you can start to get that affair partner to leave the person that they're with and start to return to the marriage and start to really work on it. But again, that comes down to when I work with people, I'm like, hey, it's your choice. I'll tell you what kind of the research is. I want to understand what your experience is, and really what this means for you. And I really get deep into that. And ultimately I give them freedom of, you know what, like, this is your life, this is your marriage, and you get the freedom to choose, you know, what's going to be for you. And usually when I see that happen, there's kind of a shift where they start to really reflect and look at, okay, what's actually going to be beneficial for my life. And there typically tends to be a return to their marriage and start to focus on it.
Because up until that point, they probably don't want to make any decision at all. They're just ambivalent and rather just keep going.
Okay, exactly.
That's good.
I got time for one more question. I got to get on a client call here.
Okay. Well, we can let's see. I don't know, Sarah. Probably we need to make a quick one or.
Just what parting words would you have for men who've been betrayed by their wives or their girlfriends? What advice would you give them specifically?
Yeah, I would. I mean, depending on where they're at, I would have them start to connect with people. And if it's an affair, I would evaluate whether you want the marriage to work, and then I would, you know, start to talk to therapists or coaches or someone who's going to start to help you process and figure out what's going to be best for you. And if it's a girlfriend, I'd start to evaluate if, you know, is this person actually someone I want to stay with? And again, that, you know, that person, maybe individual therapy might be helpful initially to really think of, you know, what's helpful. The biggest thing that I would do is I'd reach out. I'd start having conversations, because the last thing you want to do is you want to be left alone and trying to decide this and suffering by yourself, because you don't have to. As men, we think we have to, but we don't have to suffer alone. And gosh, there's a wonderful book. I'm forgetting his name. It's on like depression and men and just how they like really hold it in and try to pretend everything's okay. I'm struggling. I wish I knew it right now, but it's not coming to the top of my head. But just connect. Seriously, have those honest conversations and find someone where you can start to have someone empathize and understand what you're going through. Because being alone and staying alone will not help you at all.
Great advice. I do have one other very quick question. How does somebody find you if they want to reach out to you at all?
Yeah, the best way to find me is on my website. That's kylebenson.net. There's a ton of articles. I haven't written a ton about affairs, even though I work with affairs, but eventually I will. And I would recommend for anyone who wants to start reading about that, I'd recommend a book called What Makes Love Last by Dr. John Gottman.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Kyle, thank you so much for your time, and we really do appreciate it. It was some great information, and hopefully we can chat again sometime.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks, Kyle.
Take care.